Great.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. You are on the Toddler Sleep Teleclass. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Heather Owida. I am a co-founder of Mommy Bites with my business partner, Laura Deutsch. We are super excited for this topic for three reasons. The first is toddler sleep is always an incredibly complicated and can be incredibly stressful, but there are some tangible ways that you can help with this, which we're going to go over. Also, I'm super excited because our expert on today's teleclass, Janine Hayward, is someone that is not only a personal connection, but also a friend. I'm honored to call her a friend. And we have been working together, we just realized, for 6 or 7 years now. She was one of Mommy Bites' first experts. So it's been exciting to take this journey together with her. I'm also super excited because our sponsor of today's teleclass are also a group that not only do we know professionally, but personally, and they are Happy Family. So a little bit about Happy Family. Here's an overview, but before I give you an overview, I just want to say the people in this company are awesome. We've been working with them for years. They are truly dedicated to their products, and they are the real deal, which is why they feel passionately about putting on free classes like this, content-rich classes like this. So a huge, huge thank you to Happy Family and the people on the team. I don't want to embarrass you. You know who you are. So Happy Family is an organic food, and they're inspired by moms and developed in conjunction with pediatricians and nutritionists to provide your family with the most delicious and nourishing foods possible. Their goal truly is to make every bite count, and they have new clear packaging that lets you see exactly what you are feeding your little one, and the recipe is on the outside of the package. And so this is really goodness that you can see. If you have a chance, I'll send you the link. They have a great new website, new video that shows all this, and it's really, really super well done, and a company that you can feel proud to really be a part of. So big thank you to them. So before we get started, let me welcome our awesome expert, Janine Hayward. Hi, Janine.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Janine, before we get started, I know we have a lot to get to. Will you just tell people a few sentences about your background?
Absolutely. So I started Swell Being about 9 years ago. But prior to launching Swell Being, I had worked in schools doing play therapy with young children, and then for another parenting organization in New York City. So the lens through which I look at every situation when I'm talking with parents is really the lens of emotional health and well-being for the child as well as the entire family. So it's really a mental health lens that I'm looking through most of the time when I'm talking to parents, whether it's about positive discipline, potty training, or sleep like today.
Awesome. And Janine, I will send people the link to your website, which is chock full of resources, and I know you have some exciting new online services being offered. So I will make sure to send everyone the link to Janine and also the link to Happy Family. So let's get right to it. So can you talk a little bit about understanding kind of where your toddler's at as it relates to sleep?
Of course, absolutely. So, you know, there's a lot that changes when your child sort of shifts into that toddler or preschooler phases of development. And most notably, you know, children become much more interested in being autonomous, doing things for themselves, having a sense of personal power. You're noticing this, I'm sure, in, you know, wanting to make choices around getting dressed or, you know, experimenting a bit with the word no and sort of the power that comes with saying no to something, whether that's truly what your child's intention is or not. They pick up very quickly that you know, no is a really powerful word. They're also incredibly social. So I hear with regard to sleep, you know, there's a lot more stalling that happens or naptime resistance, which can be very confusing for parents because they also are aware that, you know, naps do eventually go away, and that can be confusing in terms of whether your child is stalling for social reasons, which I would argue most of the time, yes, they are stalling for social reasons, or whether they're just simply not tired enough. The other thing that is really difficult for toddlers and preschoolers, which is purely developmental, are transitions. So children this age are incredibly mindful. They live in the moment. They're not thinking about or giving much care, really, to what's coming next. They're just really delighting in being present in the moment. And what's challenging around sleep is that it's a pretty significant transition, going from being awake to being asleep, which is why we focus a lot on having good routines before naps and before bedtime so that we can really ease children very, very gradually into that transition to being asleep.
So Janine, keeping that in mind, I know we're going to get to kind of some specific tips and do some troubleshooting, but can you talk a little bit about how much sleep toddlers really need?
Absolutely. And this is an area where often parents are really surprised. You know, we know that newborns and infants need a lot of sleep, but there shouldn't be a really dramatic drop-off in the amount of sleep that your child is getting. If that is happening, that's usually indicative of there being, something that needs to get tweaked or fixed. So generally speaking, for children between about 18 months and 3 years of age, we want them to get 11 to 15 hours of total sleep. And I know that's a really broad range. I would say most frequently it's about 11 to 12 hours of sleep at night. And for children who are still napping during the day, that's about 1.5 to 3 hours of daytime sleep. And I should note that most toddlers will need to nap until they're at least 3 years old. So if we're talking about a preschooler, would sleep until 3. If we're talking about a 1.5 or 2-year-old, it's very unlikely that that child is ready to drop a nap. So they need to get about 1.5 to 3 hours of daytime sleep.
And Jeannie, when we're thinking about sleep, why is it so important? You know, we know why it's important for babies, infants, but why is toddler sleep so important?
So they're continuing to do a tremendous amount of growing and learning. And really, sleep is a time when our body does many important things, but those two things really are at the top of the list. So quite literally, their bodies are producing growth hormones and need that time to really kind of power down so they can fully recharge. But it's also a time when they're integrating new learning. So I like to use the example of, you know, if you always kind of took your clothes after you cleaned them and maybe pressed them and just threw them into your closet without any organizational system, you would struggle to efficiently find what you're looking for. On the other hand, if you took the time to kind of organize things in whatever system by color, by, you know, shirts and pants, you would have a much easier time finding what you're looking for. And that's really what's happening with new learning when our children are sleeping. They're making those organizational connections so they can retrieve that information much more quickly, which accelerates their learning, you know, across the board. So it's incredibly important. Also, children who don't get the sleep that they need, it impacts their mood. So they tend to be less flexible. They tend to be less happy, so more cranky, more irritable, which can, of course, then impact their relationships with us, their relationships with other friends, others, you know, other adults. So it also sort of, you know, ekes into other domains for them as well.
I'm laughing a little bit, Janine, because I now have a teenager, and the correlation between sleep and mood never changes, never ends. It's still with my teenager if he doesn't get enough sleep. It's lifelong, man, lifelong.
It's true. I mean, and I feel it too, and I talk to so many parents who, you know, echo that same sentiment back to me, that they really just don't feel like they can be the parents that they want to be or know that they are when they're sleep deprived. Yeah, absolutely, it's across the lifespan.
So before we talk about ideal sleep environments, I just want to thank everyone. I'm getting some really great questions submitted right now. So we will get to as many questions at the end. We'll go through some of these tips and then I'll start reading some of these questions, but really great ones. So thank you for those of you taking the time to write in questions. So, Janine, let's talk about ideal sleep environment for toddlers.
Absolutely. So my first number one sleep environment sort of tip is to keep your toddlers in a crib, assuming they have been sleeping in a crib. until they're at least 3 years old. And this, again, is another one of those tips that often catches parents by surprise. This has everything to do with when we generally see children develop better impulse control. And once you take off even just one side of a crib, often children experience a little to a lot more anxiety around the transition to sleep. And unfortunately, that kind of anxiety or stress, some might call it, can actually create more difficulties around going to sleep. Never mind the fact that your child now can easily get up and get out of bed and come and find you wherever you happen to be. So as long as your child isn't, you know, sort of launching themselves over the side of their crib, I would strongly encourage parents to keep their child in a crib until they're at least three. The other environmental factor that really should be unchanged from when your child was a baby is keeping the room temperature somewhere between 68 and 72 degrees. And more noteworthy is we want it to be cool enough that your child shouldn't be flushed or sweating at all when they sleep. If they are, then that's an indicator to you to either, you know, take the temperature down a couple degrees, eliminate a layer of blankets, or just lighter weight pajamas. Toddlers often have some kind of lovey or security object that they like to sleep with, and if they don't and your child is struggling with the separation, one of my favorite tips for parents is to offer a t-shirt that you've worn recently so that it smells like you. Remember that you are your child's North Star. You are everything to them. You give them all the security and comfort the world could offer to them. So something that smells like you will actually, for most kids, be embraced and be something that they really delight in being able to snuggle up with and sleep with at night. And I like the room to be as dark as possible, and this is, you know, increasingly more important now that we've gone through a time change and many children are presumably getting ready to go to sleep before the sun has fully set, depending on where you are. So using blackout shades, having some system to keep the room as dark as possible is strongly encouraged until your child starts to really express some fear around darkness. And that starts to happen for most kids around 2.5 or 3. And at that point, it may be appropriate to introduce a little nightlight so that your child can see around the room a little bit more easily. Just be mindful that sometimes nightlights will actually cast really big shadows, which creates more fear than maybe had you not introduced it at all. So just, you know, be mindful of that. And for some kids who aren't yet able to tell time but who would otherwise stay in bed until the sun rose or whatever you sort of designate as the start of the day, you might consider also introducing a toddler clock. Something, some have red light, green light. When the light turns green, they can get up and start the day. Others will be more of a night light that looks like a blue moon at night and turns to look like a sun during the day. So a tool like that might be helpful for your child if they're having a difficult time staying in bed until it's really an appropriate time to get up and start the day.
Janine, what's your feeling on sound machines?
I actually love sound machines. And for toddlers and preschoolers, it's less about that kind of soothing in utero sound that infants are soothed by. It's more about something to focus their attention on. So it's in some ways
right.
It's more of a mindfulness strategy. And it's also if you have siblings or if you live in a, you know, on a busy street, it may be an effective way to blunt some of the sharper sounds that could be a disruption to their sleep or even be a little bit scary depending on the sound.
So true. We live in the city, and we live right above a fire station. And both my boys have white noise machines. And, in fact, you can download them. When we travel, we downloaded a free app. It's, if you just type in white noise, it comes up. And it's really, really, really good and great for traveling.
Absolutely.
We have a question that just came in on getting your baby back to sleep. But I know we're going to go get to troubleshooting in a minute. So to the person that just typed that in, we will get to that as well. So I wanted to piggyback on what you said about the crib and not taking them out of the crib and into a toddler bed too soon, because it's something that comes up a lot in Mommy Bites because we do a lot of classes on preparing for a sibling. And I know it's super tempting when you have, you know, kids that are maybe 2 years apart and you want the crib for the new baby. But I just want to piggyback on what you said, that it is really, as long as you can keep them in that crib, in my opinion, and this is what you were saying too, I think the better, even if it means borrowing, a crib or toddler crib for, a few months until they outgrow it.
Absolutely. And you're right. That scenario plays out quite frequently. And the trouble with, additionally, the trouble with, moving a child out of a crib, what I consider prematurely, is that welcoming a new baby into the family, rises everybody's sort of stress level. It's joyful, it's many other things, but it is also stressful because everybody's really adapting. And that impacts your toddler's sleep. So we want to ensure that they have a place that they're really familiar with and that they feel really safe and secure for sleeping, so that you don't have a toddler and a newborn both up frequently throughout the night, which would be a lot for anyone to handle.
It's a long night. So, that's a long night.
Absolutely.
So let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk about nighttime sleep and handling stalling and tantrums and kind of the never-ending bedtime routines.
Absolutely.
Janine, are you there?
Oh, I'm here. Yes.
Oh, okay. So you just broke up for a minute. Okay, so let's talk about that. So stages, steps, what's the best way for parents to deal with that?
So we want toddlers to sleep for an average of 11 to 12 hours a night, as I had mentioned earlier. And ideally, we want this sleep to be uninterrupted, which means most toddlers are, assuming they're napping during the day, they're going to bed around 8 p.m. and sleeping through until 7 in the morning. Stalling is a really common challenge for toddlers with sleep. There's bedtime stalling, there's tantrums. And the first thing that I really want parents to know about this is that we can either bristle when our children start to, kind of dig their heels in and ask for one more story or even kind of insist on one more story. And they're doing what they need to do. This is really age-appropriate behavior. They're just really looking for some clear definition around where that limit really is around bedtime. So the best thing that we can do is really, instead of getting kind of firmer ourselves, which often I think is the direction that many of us go, take a deep breath, remind yourself that your child is doing exactly what he or she should be doing, given their developmental stage, practicing some independence, looking to have some power, looking to make some decisions, and delight in the fact that they're doing just what they should be doing. And then soften a little bit. I'm not suggesting that you sort of give in to each request that your child makes. There may be nights where that feels like that's appropriate. Of course, honey, we can read one more book. Or, sort of set yourself up for success in advance. So think about where you might be able to give your child some choices through the whole bedtime process. Would you like to read two books tonight, or would you like to read three books tonight? Would you like me to read in my silly voice, or would you like me to read in my very, very serious voice? And be sort of playful through the process, because that equals cooperation. Children like us best when we're in that really kind of playful state of mind. And there's something about the bedtime routine that often shifts us into much more of a sort of boss kind of mode. And that's something that just generally creates a little bit of tension with our children. Think about the things that your child is often asking for more of. If it's more cuddles, if it's another story, if it's a sip of water, another trip to the bathroom, and actually build that all into the bedtime routine. So maybe you have a potty break right after they come out from bath, and then maybe you do one more potty break right after stories, as an example. I know with my kids, something that worked really well for the bedtime routine was to actually physically make a checklist, put it on a clipboard, and give them each their own checklist and their own little pencil so they could kind of go through and check off each part of the routine. So it was less about me sort of dictating to them what we needed to do next and more them sort of taking control. And my questions would be more along the lines of, so now what? What comes next? Oh, that's right. We read stories. How many stories? Was it two or was it three? So that your child really feels empowered and in control through the process. And just make sure that the last thing that you do with your child as part of your bedtime routine is something that they look forward to. And I can guarantee you that they look forward to just cuddling up with you, snuggling with you, really sort of soaking in that kind of one-on-one connection that they have with you before they do the hard work of separating, which is really what sleep is all about and why we tend to have resistance in the process of the bedtime process, getting ready to go to sleep.
But that's – I've never thought about it like that, but that's so true. It's not so much a battle of the wills, although it definitely feels like that. It's a separation. It's a scared of separating, and I've never heard it worded like that.
And it's really their longest. I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's really their longest separation from us most of the time. You know, it's a
right.
Half of a full day, so it's really a pretty big deal if we look at it from their perspective.
That's right. It's so true. So I think let's pause for a minute and let's take a few questions. I just want to let people know where we're going with this conversation, so you can tuck that in the back of your mind, because we may get to some of these questions as well. But after we handle some of the calling questions, we'll talk about handling bedtime fears, the difference between a nightmare and night terror. We'll talk about handling night wakings, and then we'll talk about eventually transitioning into a big boy or big girl bed. Those are all things we'll get to. Let's pause for a minute, because we actually have a few questions that have come in around the same theme. So let me read this one. And for those of you that wrote in a similar question, just know I'm kind of honoring and grouping them together. But this caller wants to know, what's your advice for successfully having a baby sleeping in the same room as a toddler?
Oh, great question. Yeah, so for the most part, this is a really realistic scenario. My first piece of advice is make sure that the baby is sleeping through the night first before you introduce them into the room. Largely, this is because when babies consolidate and organize their sleep, usually the last feeding / waking to go is in the 4 to 5 a.m. window, and this is a really fragile, for lack of a better word, this is a really fragile time of the night, because melatonin has left your child, your older child's system. So they are much more easily awoken in that sort of last 3 hours of the night. So again, in the interest of not having two children up at 4 or 5 a.m., I would encourage you to wait until the baby is first sleeping all the way through until 6 or 7. Then when you're ready to make the transition, you know, you can certainly have the baby napping in that shared bedroom, the children's bedroom, during the daytime, well before that transition, just so your baby has some exposure to sleeping in that room before you make the transition at night. When you make the transition at night, first have a conversation with your older child about how tonight, or, you know, one day soon, little brother, little sister will start sleeping in the same room with them. And often this is a really welcome addition for your older child. They get very excited, really interested in sharing a space. So you definitely, you know, have that impression going into it, because that's very likely how it will be received from your older child. But practically speaking, setting up the room so that the two children will have a difficult time seeing one another is you know, a really important thing to take note of. Sometimes that means just simply placing a piece of furniture between the two, you know, cribs or the two beds. Other times I've had parents actually install a curtain that they, you know, they close at night, but they otherwise keep open during the day. Some sort of visual obstruction is really, really helpful, because all it takes is your little one just making eye contact with your older child for your little one to very gleefully become very wakeful and very excited, and they can fuel off of that one another. The other thing is something we've already touched on, which is white noise. So having white noise in the room with two children, from my perspective, is an imperative. Again, it's not going to mask the sounds that each other makes, but it will blunt anything that, you know, could potentially awaken a child who's transitioning to a lighter stage of sleep. And with that white noise machine, I would position it closer to the child that you think maybe would awaken more likely. So maybe the baby would be the one to awaken the older child. You'd want to position the white noise machine a little closer to your older child, so they're hearing the sound from the white noise machine first, and the sound that your younger child or your baby is making second, so it will be less disruptive.
Okay, it's very good advice. And the part about them not being able to see each other, I think I had two sons that were sharing a room at one point, and we put a little bookshelf in between, and that was kind of enough. And of course, the white noise. Janine, I wanted to speed in. Oh, we're getting so many good questions. Let's do this one, and then maybe we'll move on to bedtime fears, because a few of the questions that have just come in, I think, have to do with waking up in the night, and this ties into bedtime fears. But let's do this one. Can you please share your thoughts on toddlers falling asleep on your bed and being transferred? Is this a bad pattern, even if they have no issues with staying asleep in their own crib or room for 11 to 12 hours? Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'm a big believer of if it's not a problem, then it's not a problem. You know, if they're able to fall asleep in one room and then transition to another room and stay asleep and not wake up and be disoriented or distressed because they're somewhere else other than where they fell asleep, then it's working. And that especially is common in small spaces, again, where there may be a sibling and they have different bedtimes. So if it's working, great. You know, you can continue to do that as long as you can physically carry that child back to their bed. On the other hand, what can happen, and this would then be a problem that you likely would want to, you know, focus on and give some attention to, is that idea of disorientation. So sometimes children and even babies, if they fall asleep in one place, which can be on your lap, in your bed, and then later, 3 hours, 4 hours later, awaken in a different place, that can cause a significant amount of distress. So if that were to be the case, then I would say you want to really start practicing having your child fall asleep in the very same place that you intend for them to sleep for the duration of the night.
Right, right. That's a good point. But I agree with you. If this particular toddler is then sleeping 11 to 12 hours uninterrupted, like, knock yourself out. I would, whatever you know you're doing is working.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, I know I said we were going to move right on, but this one actually ties into falling asleep. So would love some guidance on dropping the pre-bed bottle. Oh, this is a big one. It's part of how my 17-month-old falls asleep. She'll fall asleep in my arms while drinking her bottle, and I transfer her to the crib. I know we need to get her to fall asleep on her own, but she loves that bottle, runs into the bedroom for it. Huh. So that's interesting.
Right.
This is actually a very interesting question because you mentioned before that the last thing they do before they fall asleep should be something they look forward to, and this is obviously something that this toddler looks forward to. So what to do? I know that there's actually there's a medical reason. I know you'll probably touch on why it's probably good to drop this routine.
Yeah, well, so, you know, interestingly, at 17 months, you know, your pediatrician isn't recommending that you stop feeding altogether, though that's soon. You know, often, and again, this would be something to check in with your pediatrician about specifically for your child, but often parents will get the green light to stop feeding right before bed at about 18 months. So you're definitely on the cusp of a transition anyway. So, you know, whether you want to kind of do those two things at once and drop the bottle altogether or change what you're giving her in the bottle is really up to you. But what I would suggest that you do is that often, so children around sleep, like so many other things, they form associations. So she associates sort of snuggling up with you on your lap, probably in a specific chair or a specific, you know, part of the bed or in the room. Those things are all very kind of interconnected, intertwined. So the first thing that I often suggest to parents when they're making this transition is not to sit in that spot. So instead, what you can do, and you'll be switching up the routine a little bit, in a scenario where you're offering her, say, a sippy cup of water as an alternative, which won't be met with the same, you know, delight as the bottle of milk, you can sit on the floor, pull her in close so that she's not also experiencing a loss around that connected, snuggly, cozy time with you. So you're only tweaking what you're offering her and where you're offering her, but you're still offering her something, which would be water from a sippy cup, and you're making sure that you still have that kind of cozy, close connection. So instead of holding her in your arms in a position that she's used to falling asleep in, you might just pull her back to your chest and kind of envelop her with your arms and your legs and, you know, read a couple extra stories. Make sure that you still have the same amount of time together like you do when she's drinking the bottle, but not kind of trigger her associations or her expectations by sitting in that place where you normally would sit. Now, the next part is really much bigger, which is how she falls asleep. So the bottle is a part of how she falls asleep, and without the bottle, she's probably fallen asleep feeding for some time. So without the bottle, she actually has to learn a new way to fall asleep. And this is, a big step. It's certainly something she's capable of, and she'll probably impress you with how quickly she figures it out. But there are a couple of ways that you can go about doing that. And I don't know if I'm jumping ahead or if I should maybe hold off on that part.
Well, do you want it? Should we table it? Talk about fears, and then go through. It's up to you.
Yeah. Let's do that. I'll definitely come back to it. But there are a couple of sort of. I have two favorite methodologies for children learning / practicing falling asleep at bedtime more independently, and then thus falling back asleep in the middle of the night. So I'll definitely review that part of it when we get there.
Perfect. Okay, so let's transition to handling bedtime fears. And before we do that, I just want to pause for a moment and give a big shout-out, thank you again, to Happy Family Organic Foods that are the sponsor of today's teleclass. I will send you a link to their website, but they're inspired by moms and developed in conjunction with pediatricians and nutritionists to provide your family with the most delicious and nourishing foods possible, and they have awesome new packaging where you can see inside of exactly what you're feeding your toddler. So I will send the link to them and a big thank you and shout out to them. Handling bedtime fears. So what should we do or not do?
Yeah, so the first thing to be really careful about is not, what we sometimes call leading the witness, is not sort of planting the idea that there is something that your child is afraid of. And we often do this sort of unwittingly as we sort of rush to our child when they wake up and they're clearly distressed and we say, are you afraid of something? Did something scare you? When that may truly be the case, but when it's not, children pick up very quickly that there's something about being afraid or being fearful that gets a reaction from us, and a very strong reaction often quickly. So, we want to certainly be sensitive to any distress that they have, and we want to be responsive and empathic. Just be careful not to have such a strong reaction that you really kind of punctuate that event for your child, and they start to have frequent wakings where they say, guess what, I'm scared again, which can happen. We also want to be mindful, and I hear this from parents pretty frequently, that we don't sort of project our own childhood experiences and fears onto our children. They may have similar fears, but they may not. So we really want to be careful about ideas around kind of loneliness or fears of abandonment and sort of projecting that onto our children when that may not at all be their experience around sleep. And I'm guessing it probably isn't for so many people who are willing to, take an hour of their day today and really log in and listen to this conversation. It's something that you're very thoughtful and intentional about. That said, children absolutely are fearful around falling asleep, certainly in different stages of their development. They become much more aware of how small and how vulnerable they are, and this often plays out with themes of good versus evil in their play. You be the bad guy, I'll be the good guy, I'll be the fireman, I'll rescue you from the burning building. We hear that a lot in 2- and 3-year-olds, and that really speaks to their understanding of the world being much more complicated and, frankly, having a lot of scary elements to it. So we certainly want to be sensitive to that as well. So this is where it's really important to kind of fine-tune your empathy skills and really lean into your child and say, tell me more about that. Boy, that does sound scary. I would feel scared, too, if something like that were to happen. And then offer a really good dose of reassurance. Mommy is here. Daddy is here. We're here to keep you safe. You are safe in your house. So that message is both understanding the feeling that your child is communicating, either verbally or even through their behavior or the stories that they're sharing, and also offering that sense of reassurance. And again, if we don't overreact or have a fearful response to this anxiety around falling asleep, our children's really taking their cues from us. You know, if they sense a sense of calm from us, then that's something that they borrow and they use to help them to feel, you know, comfortable and safe and be reassured in the transition to sleep.
I'll share something that I think I've shared in the past that worked when my son was a toddler and he was feeling scared and not wanting to separate from me. So, you know, first we started, you know, I would sit on his floor until he fell asleep, and then I'd sit in the doorway, and then I'd sit outside the room. But, you know, it was still like I really never got further than the doorway. So he wanted to kind of feel, like, connected to me. So I bought this big, bright purple ribbon, and he fell asleep holding one end of the ribbon, and I would hold the other end of the ribbon in the other room, like if I was in the kitchen. It was a long ribbon in the kitchen or in the TV room. And, like, so and that was enough for him to feel that we were kind of connected. So sometimes it's just like doing different things. I will say, obviously, I would wait, you know, he'd fall asleep in about 10 minutes, and of course I would take the ribbon away because it's obviously not safe to have a child sleeping with anything long or a ribbon like that. But I guess the idea was more to kind of think about like what was going on in his head, and it wasn't that he was trying to be kind of belligerent. He just needed to feel connected in a different way. So.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's such a lovely example of how you adapted your behavior to meet his needs. And I think it's really important. I mean, it's frustrating, and I know it because I've certainly had sleep challenges of my own with my children because they're children. And, you know, is that they're really not aiming to upset us. In fact, they're hardwired for quite the opposite. They really hunger to feel like there's a good, healthy connection with us. And, you know, that separation for sleep, as we talked about, can be really challenging for some children. And there's a book that I like, and you reminded me of it by your example with the ribbon. It's called The Invisible String. And I recommend it to probably every parent that I talk to who has a toddler or a preschooler. And it's really illustrating that metaphor that we are connected by these invisible strings, and you can sometimes make it concrete like you did, to the people that we love, and that we can, you know, kind of pull on those strings to communicate that I missed you today, you know, I'm thinking about you. And it's a really great book. I've had so many parents come back to me and say, you know, that book is something my child really loves, and we read it all the time. And it's just been a great way to talk about the feelings that we have around the separation for sleep or other kinds of separations. But obviously, you know, we're talking about sleep, and that's the way that I most commonly will use that book. So it's by Patrice Karst, K-A-R-S-T, if people are interested in picking up a copy.
And I'll make sure and include that in the follow-up link of resources, Karst. Okay, that sounds great. Janine, quickly, what's the difference between a nightmare and a night terror?
Okay. Yeah, sometimes those two are used interchangeably, but a nightmare is more common. A nightmare is typically going to happen in the second half of the night, so after midnight. And your child will awaken from a nightmare, feeling trembling, feeling scared, maybe are able to articulate, you know, some of the content of that nightmare, but they will be able to be soothed by you. A night terror, on the other hand, tends to be genetic. So it can, you know, follow some genetic path in your family where maybe you've had night terrors or some other kind of parasomnia. But a night terror is not something that your child is aware of when they're having it, and they don't have any recollection of having one. And children who have night terrors, typically they're triggered by stress, which in my line of work often means that children are overtired, and resolving, you know, ensuring that they're getting enough sleep often resolves that pattern of having night terrors. They typically will happen in the first few hours after your child has fallen asleep. And they should not be awoken from them. They will just sort of naturally pass on their own. Of course, you should go and witness them and make sure that your child, if they're sort of thrashing around, isn't at risk of harming themselves. But it's not something that you want to try to awaken them from. They, like I said, they won't remember it. It's a very stressful to observe as a parent, but it isn't something that your child is going to be stressed about afterwards. You really then just want to work on minimizing whatever the stressors or the triggers are that are causing the night terror in the first place.
That's very good advice, and it's hard to witness. It's hard to witness if you
yeah.
have a child that's ever had a night terror, but it's good. It's reassuring to know that they don't remember it. It's just kind of part of their sleep pattern at that particular time.
Exactly.
One of the things my husband and I did when our son would have nightmares is we bought some of that organic like lavender pillow spray, and we would come in and we would say, you know, this is to help you have nice dreams. And it was like, it was like the ribbon, like a tangible, like they could smell the difference in the air, and it kind of in their mind associated with like, okay, mommy sprayed this and now I'm not going to have bad dreams. So anyway,
right.
Whatever.
Oh, dream catchers can do that. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, dream catchers. Oh, we have that too. Oh, we have it all, Janine. We have a dream catcher. Oh, yes, we do.
Wonderful. I do too. One in each room. But yeah, I mean, I think the other thing to note about nightmares or really just when your child is feeling really anxious is that their nervous system is hyper-aroused. So anything you can do, whether it's whatever sense you're appealing to, if it's their sense of smell with a lavender spray, and I do have a child that will do sometimes a lavender oil when she's having a hard time falling asleep, and for her, that really works. But anything to kind of, if it's deep breaths, if it's giving them nice kind of arm and leg squeezes to really help actually relax the nervous system, being relaxed is the necessary state of being in order to fall asleep. So paying attention to that and thinking about how you can help your child when they are kind of hyper aroused, whether it's from anxiety or a nightmare, is definitely the direction to go.
Right. Yes, that's right. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about bedtime routines and handling night wakings.
Okay, great. So I know that you're hearing a common theme for me, which is really around connection, but I believe really strongly in that we really want to give children the sense of really feeling filled up on us before they have to do the work of separating around sleep. So, sometimes as children get over, our bedtime routine gets a little sloppier or we're a little less consistent. They certainly have more going on in their lives, so sometimes that's the necessary shift. But to the extent possible, I would really urge parents to protect that last 15 to 20 minutes of time before your child goes to sleep. So this is usually after a bath or a shower, where you're going into your child's room or the room in which your child sleeps and having some time to finish your ritual. Often this is story time, reading stories or telling stories. Maybe reviewing your child's day, talking about the next day, whatever it is, this is a really important time to reconnect, especially if you've been apart because of work or because of school schedules. Your child will really look forward to that connection, so it should really be distraction-free. It should be consistent, something your child can really depend on. And I would encourage you to do a lot of touch, toddlers still need a lot of touch, but they get so much less than when they were babies. So really filling them up on that idea of kind of having baby time. Pull them onto your lap and really fill them up on touch and that kind of intimacy that helps us to feel connected in a healthy way with people that we care about. Now thinking about night wakings. So night wakings often are a symptom of, certainly there's nightmares that cause night wakings, but more commonly night wakings are indicative of children who are overtired. So night wakings tend to be that pattern. Or if a child has had help to fall asleep at bedtime, then they will often awaken at some point or multiple times through the night looking for help to fall back asleep. It's just a learned behavior and a learned pattern. In either scenario, there really are two strategies that I'm a big fan of, and they tend to be, what I consider moderate, but they put the relationship first, which is really important. So in one scenario, and I think, Heather, this is really similar to what you described doing with your son, you stay with them until they fall asleep, and your message to your child is, oh, I'll be here till you fall asleep, sweetheart. I love you. Good night. And that's really the extent of the talking that you do. If your child starts to get upset or worked up again, every so often, maybe every 3 to 4 or 5 minutes, you will very calmly relate that same message back to them. Sweetie, mommy's here. Daddy's here. It's time to go night-night. I love you. Good night. And the message beforehand is really that you'll stay until they fall asleep, which is what children want. They want that sense of security as they transition sort of to the other side and go from being awake to being asleep. So then in the middle of the night when they wake up, you need to repeat that same thing. So you need to come back into the room to that very same spot that you were at bedtime and very calmly remind your child, of course, you're there. It's time for sleep. So you're setting a firm but kind limit. It's time for sleep, sweetheart. Mommy's here. Daddy's here. Good night. And you sit in that spot again until your child returns to sleep, however long it takes. And you repeat that process for the duration of the night. Now, each night, the objective should be that you move a little bit further away from your child. So if you need to rub their back for a few nights, you can do that. But maybe by the fourth night, you're too far away to rub your child's back. So now you're just sitting in the room. Eventually, after about a week or so, you will make it to the door of their room. And then the transition, which is the biggest one of all, is getting to the other side of the door. But for some children, this very slow kind of progressive movement, to having a parent further and further away from them as they fall asleep, it's the sweet spot for them. For other kids, the other approach that I like is a much more straightforward, it tends to work more quickly, and can be equally well received, is the I'll check on you approach. So with this approach, you explain to children the afternoon before you make a shift that things will be a little bit different at bedtime tonight, and then you practice with them during the daytime what that process will look like. So you will actually have your child climb into bed and say, okay, now this isn't bedtime. I know we're just pretending, but when I say goodnight tonight, I'm going to go to the door. I'm going to blow you a kiss and say night-night, and then I will leave, but I will come back and check on you in a few minutes or in a short time. And then you practice leaving and coming back and checking on them. And now you're just going to the door of the room, and you're cracking the door open a little bit, and you're waving, blowing a kiss. Or if your child probably can't see you, you will then have to say, I'm checking on you, sweetheart. I love you. Good night. And you will repeat that check-in, and your child will know this. You'll repeat that check-in as many times as it takes for your child to fall asleep. So you're not staying in the room the whole time, but you're also helping them with that transition around separations by coming back at some frequency, whether it's every 3 minutes, every 4 minutes, every 5 minutes, and pausing at the door very briefly just to acknowledge that you're doing the check-in, to remind them that it's time for sleep and that you'll be back, and then you leave. And for some kids, just knowing that you're checking on them is incredibly powerful, and it allows them to be relaxed enough that they can then drift to sleep.
I couldn't agree more with that. And that goes on, by the way, that technique right through, you know, preschool, not just toddlers. But I would just kind of piggyback on that and say that, you know, what Janine just said about really genuinely, it's not that you're not trying to fake them out. Like, you genuinely do go back every few minutes and just poke your head in. Because I think the temptation is, okay, I'll be right back, and then to never go back, right? Because you're like, oh,
right,
I don't want to wake them, or I don't want them to get excited. They see me again. But I think that that causes the sensation of more angst, because it's kind of like, well, are they going to come back? Or the first time you say you're going to come back and you don't, right? I mean, I would assume that's
absolutely
kind of not the way to do it.
And no, you're absolutely right. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because it's really, both of these approaches are really built on trust that you'll be where you say you're going to be, or that you'll come back when you say you're going to come back. And when children can trust that we will do what we say we're going to do, they are much more relaxed. So it's a much easier process for them to do the work of kind of letting go and drifting to sleep. So you absolutely, it's the same thing with toddlers and just leaving and saying goodbye. It's often tempting to sneak out when they're engaged and having a good time because you know they're going to protest you leaving. But it's much more important that you have a clean goodbye, and that your child knows that you would never just vanish without giving them a heads up first. And I would say, yeah, you know, this is actually an approach that worked really well with my older daughter. And she's 9, as I've mentioned. And she, to this day, we say our goodnights, and then we do a 1-2-minute check-in every night.
Yep.
And there's just something for her about knowing that I will come back after 2 minutes. And it's this sweet. I open the door and I say, okay, sweetie, this is my 2 minute check-in. I love you. And she says, good night, very gleefully, and goes to sleep. And it's just for her younger sister, you know, she sort of boots me out. But again, she has a different temperament. So we really want to have options so we can match the solution to the child the best we possibly can.
It's so true. That is so true. So I'm just looking at the clock, and we are coming down the home stretch here. So I see questions are still coming in. For the caller that just asked the question, she said her 2.5-year-old has suddenly began hating bedtime nap time. She used to go down easily, now fights. And then she says at the end that she was, you know, previously sleeping through the night. This has just started, but she's very pregnant. And I think this question came in right before your tips on handling night wakings. So I think to this caller, I believe that was answered. The tips kind of Janine just went over. And if not, do feel free to shoot me a follow-up email. But I'm pretty sure she went over, I think, what your question was. So before we move on to transitioning to a big boy or big girl bed, which is kind of our last segment of this conversation, another caller question that came in was, you're feeling on kind of the cry it out method at this stage in development, you know, the toddler, young toddler stage.
Yeah. So I'm going to make an assumption that what that caller means by the cry it out method is, you know, saying goodnight and then not going back in. And if your caller means something else, then I would love to hear that. But that's the assumption I'm going to make. And yes, I'm not a fan of it. Again, because children feel so vulnerable at this age. And actually, I'm not a fan of it in general. So that would span, you know, newborns all the way through. Now, with a 5-minute check-in, your child may, in fact, be crying. So it's okay if your child is distressed for you to leave for periods of time and then come back in and offer some reassurance. But if your child is really, really worked up, then you need to notch it up and go in and do a little bit more to offer some assistance to your child and really help them to be more calm. They may still cry some through the process, although often the check-ins sort of nip that pretty quickly. But an approach where you're closing the door and not going back in will, you know, generally children when they're crying will go through phases where they will start to kind of explore, which is often when they start discovering ways to self-soothe. But then they start to worry the longer, you know, the time passes before a parent sort of checks in or reassures them. And then they can start to panic. So in some ways, that style of sleep training can actually make things worse instead of making them better. So I would advise that parents either do some version of that kind of check-in approach that I talked about or something even more gradual, like the first approach where they stay in the room and then slowly phase themselves out.
Follow-up question, Janine, that just came in. So this parent wants to know, what if your child is standing in the crib shrieking the entire time you're in the room waiting for them to fall asleep? My son is 17 months old and just stares at me shrieking. Good question.
Right. So that's a great example of how that may not be the best fit for that particular child, because being in the room instead of being, you know, a comfort is actually creating more frustration
or more distress. Right, yeah.
Exactly. So I will often, if parents say, gosh, I don't really know, in this case, pretty clearly, I would say it's probably going to be a little easier on the child if the parent were to leave and then come back.
Right.
In 17 months, 18 months is a really common age for children to have kind of a second wave of separation anxiety. So is 2.5. So for that other parent who's also having a new baby soon, you know, it's probably a combination of a shift developmentally and just some awareness that some big changes are, you know, just around the corner. But, yeah, if you're not sure, I would say start with the more gradual approach, and then as you get data from your child that this is actually really frustrating or really upsetting for them, then you can shift to the other approach.
And just a quick follow-up to that. So this parent wants to know, with the strategies that you went over, Janine, for night waking, at what age do kids understand this? I have a 19-month-old. That's a good question. So, like, at what age can you kind of start having these conversations, telling them I'll be right back? Like, what age developmentally can you, is the youngest you could start this?
Well, honestly, you know, that kind of check-in parents are doing with six-month-olds. And I always suggest to parents that you, regardless of how old your baby, your toddler, your preschooler is, you always tell them what you're doing. And always assume that your child has a, you know, without getting too complicated with your wording, that they have a pretty basic understanding of what you're saying. But more importantly, your behaviors will tell the full story. So mommy will be back, daddy will come soon and check on you. You know, your six-month-old isn't going to understand what that means, but they're going to experience the rhythm of the repeated check-ins and be able to make predictions based on that. So a 19-month-old, their receptive language is probably a year further out from their expressive language. So a 19-month-old understands a lot. And some of this you can experiment with by, you know, asking your 19-month-old to do a one or two-step task. You know, go get your red shoes, or, you know, mommy, go get mommy's phone and bring it back. And if your child is able to understand and follow through with their behavior, it's a good indicator of how much your child really does understand. But know that it's really more the consistency of our behavior that children learn what they can expect from versus what we say. So I would encourage a combination of articulating what your child can expect from you and then following through very consistently.
Got it. Okay. That's great. Thank you. So, all right, here's the situation, everyone. So it's almost two. So if Janine, if you're up for it for staying on a teensy bit over, then maybe we can have a little bit of time to talk about transitioning to a big girl, big boy bed. Does that work for your time and your end? Okay. So,
absolutely.
So for those listeners that have carved out this hour and have to go, so let me just kind of bring closure. We have taped this, and we'll be sending you a link to this taped call as well as resources. If you do have to go, we'll cover transitioning to toddler bed now. And in that email will be the link. It will be resources. It will be the book Janine went over. It will be other tidbits that Janine, you know, thinks that will be helpful. It will be the information to our awesome sponsor of today's teleclass, Happy Family, and also Janine's contact information. So that will be we'll try to get that to you guys in the next sort of three days or so. So on that note, too, another big thank you to Janine Hayward for carving out the time to do this. She's incredible, and as I mentioned before, we've been working with her for years. And also, of course, a huge, huge thank you to Happy Family Organic Foods. They are awesome. They are committed to high-quality content, and not only food, but high-quality parenting content, and we have a few more in the series coming up with them. So on that note, okay. So, and also I'm shutting down questions for now just so we can get to this. So I'm sorry anyone that has, I tried to get to most questions, but if I didn't get to yours, I'm sorry. But okay, transitioning to a toddler bed. What are the things parents
Yes.
should know and do?
Right. So this is a process. You certainly don't want to make this transition in haste. That often doesn't lead to the best outcome. So if parents just suddenly, you know, if their child is attempting to climb out of the crib or maybe has even successfully done it once, I would urge you not to make the assumption that you need to make that transition swiftly that same day. You know, one thing, you know, to keep your child in the crib a little bit longer is I encourage the use of a sleep sack all the way through the first three years where your child would be in a crib, because that certainly kids can still get out in a sleep sack, but far fewer even attempt it because their range of motion is restricted. However, when it's time to make this transition for whatever reason, I would encourage you to, you know, purchase the new bed and position it in the same location where your child's crib currently had been, I should say. So you'll move the crib and you'll put the bed in the same place, if that makes sense to the layout of the room. Ideally, though, we want the new bed to have some sense of containment. So sometimes that means you can push it up to a corner. So there's a wall on two sides and then a long guardrail on the other open side. Or if it floats in the room a little bit and that's just what makes sense for your child's room, then I would encourage you to put a long guardrail on both sides. So we really want children to feel this sense of cozy containment and really safety. So you can sort of rim the bed with little pillows or little stuffed animals. We want it to feel very cozy, very nest-like, very welcoming, because that's what children seem to really prefer when they're going to sleep. To the extent that your child can make little decisions around maybe bedding or even the location of the bed, whether it's 2 inches to the left or 2 inches to the right, you know, the degree to which they feel like they have some sense of control and they're a part of the process can help the outcome be very favorable. Now, when you make the transition, I would encourage you to do that in the morning so your child has an opportunity to take a nap in the bed first. So their first time practicing sleeping in a big bed would be during the daytime, and then the next time that they would sleep in their big bed would come at night. And, you know, it's helpful to give children some reminders, just like you would in the crib. So if you have a child who's trying to get out of the crib before you're really ready to make that transition, sometimes a simple, kind, but firm limit is really all it takes. Sweetie, it's not safe to climb out of the crib. If you need mommy, say, mommy, daddy, and we will come and we will help you, but you may not climb out of the crib. You know, something as simple as that can buy you weeks or months of your child safely sleeping in their crib. Same thing with the big bed. So when you make the transition to the big bed, you know, letting your child know that it's important that they stay in their bed for the whole night, and if they need something, they can call for you and you will come. And then obviously, as we've talked earlier, if that happens, then of course you want to follow through by coming and you know, helping your child with whatever need they may have or want they may have in that moment, and then quickly returning to your bed and letting your child stay asleep in his or her bed. And in my experience, if this transition happens at age 3 or 3.5 or 4, it tends to be a really smooth transition. As I said earlier, children have pretty good impulse control. They're pretty well practiced on the idea of there being rules. They may be in nursery school where they have rules that they need to follow. So having, you know, rules for the new big bed, just very basic rules, stay in bed, call for help if you need it, you know, have sweet dreams, you know, things like that can be really all it takes to ensure that this transition goes smoothly.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that, Janine. I'm sorry we're pressed for time at the end. We have so many great questions and so much good stuff to get to. I want to thank Janine. I want to thank Happy Family. I want to thank all of our awesome callers that joined us today. I will be sending you a link to this. And Janine, thank you so much.